an old man's memories, because this is all that old men have, the memories, and like all memories, they tend to be fictionalized. You reconstruct your life, so so I'll ask you to bear with me, and mainly I'll be talking about the 1980s for obvious reasons, but if people do want to discuss more recent events and canals and so on and so forth, so I'll be happy to do that in the Q&A. But I'm sticking to the 1980s for the reasons that I will explain, or hope to explain now. I think the first thing that you need to remember, if you're not familiar with Nicaragua, is that Nicaragua has been in a state of conflict for almost exactly 100 years. That is to say, there's been no period at which it can be truly said that Nicaragua has been at peace, right, during the last 100 years. Now, if you just look at this story, well, the US Marines occupied Nicaragua in 1912, right, and were there in some form or another until 1934. That's 22 years of occupation in some form or another. A thing that has been completely wiped out of the collective memory of the US. It's very interestingly, when the Sandinistas were there, and I don't remember, there was a sort of scandal about the Russians were building bases and so on and so forth, and the Cubans and so on. I think it was Colin Powell or somebody produced to the Congress huge pictures of, aerial pictures of Nicaragua showing baseball diamonds, and this was absolute evidence that there was Cuban presence there. But of course, the baseball is brought not by Cubans but by the US Marines. That's why there are baseball diamonds in all the army bases in Nicaragua, simply because the Marines occupied the country. It's also, interestingly, we are brought up, for example, to believe that Guernica was the first case of the use of dive bombers against civilian populations. But in fact, the first example was actually in Ocotal, in Nicaragua, that was by the US Marines, as you'll find in the US Marine history, quite proud of it. Then they installed the Somoza family, which stayed in power to 79. In 1961, the FSLN, the Frente Sandinista de Liberación Nacional, was founded. It's important day because it's after the Cuban Revolution. But things really began to get going after Managua was flattened in an earthquake in 1972, and this had a sort of huge social consequences, and the FSLN insurgency really got going in a big way, particularly urban insurgency after that. The key dates, the period that I'm talking about, 1979, the FSLN led a popular uprising in the urban areas of Nicaragua, backed up by other uprisings in the mountains, and they won a victory eventually against Somoza, although the fighting went on for over 5 years, from 74 to 79. 1981, with the end of the Carter administration, had been fairly benign. The Reagan administration decided that they wanted to get rid of the Sandinistas, and put enormous pressure on, which I'll be talking about. 1984, there were elections, which the FSLN won, but that wasn't enough, and the pressure went on right up through the 1987 Esquipulas Peace Accords, where all the Central American governments agreed to stop fighting, but the pressure went on, and in 1990, the FSLN lost the elections and lost power. And that's the period I'm talking about today. Just for the record, in 1996 and 2001, the FSLN 0.2, that is in a new, reformed shape, the party lost the elections but still held about 40% of the vote. And in 2006 and 2011, they won the elections again, with margins similar, sort of 45% of the vote. So that's just the historical background. The point is that at no point during this entire period has there really been peace or social concord or a sort of stable social order throughout the 100 years. Well, this revolution, arguably it's the last socialist revolution possibly in the world, actually, in 79. It's difficult to find examples after that. But certainly it was a very Latin American revolution. In the sense that it's can only be understood within the context of the sort of Latin American left, if you like. It's a pity that Alan Angel isn't here, because this is very much his sort of subject. In the 1970s, the revolutionary movements in Latin America were very much dominated by the Cuban model, although traditional communist parties, with their emphasis on urban proletariats, and a sort of, you know, classical revolution were important. And also the influence of Maoism was also quite influential in Latin America at that time. And then I've left this out, but I mean, there is obviously the impact of the Chilean model. Although again, the impact on the left, of course, was that peaceful democratic roads to power didn't work, because you'd then be displaced immediately. So that it was necessary to continue with an armed revolution. Now, the Nicaraguans really invented a quite different, or considerably different brand, if you like, and the important thing was particularly the Sandinistas were divided into three fractions, if you like. One of them, which was the Guerra Popular Prolongada, which was for long-term fighting in the mountains, the Tendencia Proletaria, the proletarians, who were said that the revolutionary force would be the proletarians on the plains, particularly rural proletarians in large farms and so on, because there wasn't many factories, and the Terceristas, who believed in an uprising based on large-scale urban masses, what we'd now call new social movements, the involvement of the Catholic Church and so on. So in a sense, the Terceristas represented what we now recognize as the Latin American left, right? And the other two fractions are, you know, the past, if you like, the Communist Party line on the proletariat, and the, if you like, the Maoist or particular, or to some extent, Cuban line, that it's fighting in the mountains, the what counts. And they generated a very successful urban insurrection and swept into power in July of 79. This meant that they came into power with a broad political alliance and also a very vivid awareness that the world had changed, that the construction of socialism wasn't going to be an easy task and a sort of classical model of a Russian or a Cuban kind, or even a Vietnamese kind, that it would have to be a rather different form of peripheral socialism, of both politically and economically. It was going to have to be very different from what the Cuban models and so on said. Incidentally, the Cuban advisors and the Vietnam advisors were very keen on this. They said, for God's sake, the one thing you do, don't copy what we did. I mean, that was one of the first things that Fidel said to the Sandinistas, and the same that the Vietnamese said. It's quite interesting in a sense that this is the result of long Latin American debates during the late 60s and early and mid 70s about what the nature of a revolution could look like, given the problems so far. Well, you may ask, what on earth was I doing? why am I speaking with such authority on the subject? As one does, I was a young development economist teaching in Cambridge. And one of my graduate students, needless to say, was heavily involved with them. I was already working on what are called intermediate regimes, as a place like Peru and Mexico, which were at that time following or attempting to follow a different development path from just a straight market path. We were actually in Mexico at the time in 79, working for the Mexican government, and this former student rang. They entered Managua on the 19th of July 1979. I think about the 20-something, and rang up and said, why wasn't I there? They were waiting for me. They had told me they were going to win, hadn't they? And yes, they had. But then I have to remember that students then and now tend to tell you they're about to rise in arms, but one tended perhaps not to believe it, and they had actually won. So I was shipped in. First I worked in the planning ministry with a guerrilla commander, Henry Ruiz Modesto, who had a rather slightly nerve-wracking habit of wearing grenades on his lapels, which is when you're sitting somewhere working over spreadsheets and so on, is slightly off-putting.
I forgot to wear my grenades today.
You didn't wear your grenades, no. But yours would have been sort of Louis Vuitton. Sort of designer grenades.
He's a Sandinista after all.
Yes. And then I was shifted to the presidency, the president's office with the junta, and then Daniel Ortega. And for a whole series of reasons, I attended cabinet meetings and so on as the senior economic advisor. We arrived in August of 79. We stayed on in one form or another about the end of 86, but then started to work, as we see, on the international Court of Justice case of reparations against the US until 1990. Well, there's a photograph of me. That's my identity card. You can see how young and handsome I was then. You're not supposed to say you're still young and handsome.
You're still young and handsome, I'm sorry.
That's your job as chairperson. It's supposed to be a double act. You're not supposed to say that. Anyway, that's me looking... Actually, looking sort of romantically into the horizon, isn't it? Rather nice, isn't it? So that was what I was doing. This is a quotation from Sergio Ramirez, who is the probably mostly you know as a novelist, but was actually vice president at that time. And he says, "You want me to read in Spanish or English or not at all? Does everybody speak Spanish here or no? Oh, I'll read it out." So this is his memoir called Adios Muchachos, Una Memoria de la Revolución Sandinista, Goodbye, Children. This is his memory of the revolution. Economic development is a difficult dream to make congruent and work, and the war simply always interrupted us, everything. But given these difficulties and disasters, we began to think of an hybrid between central planning and market economy, no less unreal. According to the thesis of the famous Polish professor Kalecki, who within the presidency was proposed by one of his disciples, the British economist Valpy Fitzgerald. So that's what I was doing there. I think it's a nice quote, not only because of what he says, but also because he gives the quite real impression that it was all this period is rather like a novel or something, the whole thing. So what were they trying to do? Well, firstly, the experience of Cuba and Russia and so on and so forth was that really you had to have a mixed economy. You couldn't have state control of the whole economy. What were called the commanding heights, mainly in state hands, because Somoza and his group had owned them, particularly the export sectors, mining, large cotton estates and so on, and the banks, and so that these all became public property by default. The lessons from Cuba, the mistakes the Cubans had made, plus this theory of Kalecki's about intermediate regimes, suggested that small producers should be allowed to go on being small producers and not nationalised. The foreign firms should be negotiated with rather than trying to nationalise them. And as a whole, the mixed economy seems to have been fairly stable in the sense, but it wasn't terribly dynamic, so that it seemed to more or less work, but not actually lead to the sort of growth that they were expecting. What really made the economy not work was the enormous pressure from the US, which I'll discuss below, despite continued aid from Europe and elsewhere. So another factor in this revolution, unlike other ones, was that there was considerable aid flows from, obviously not from the US, but from Europe during this period, and then a series of other mixed bag of countries across the world, as well as obviously from the Soviet bloc. Now, the scale of the problem we're trying to face, as you can see here, and if I can get the cursor to work. Right, so this is the the Somoza period leading up to the actual revolution, whereas you can see there was some growth, but relatively little. Now, the actual war and insurrection led to income per capita actually falling from about $2,000 down to a little over 1,000. There was a 40% drop, right? A far greater drop. These are the World Bank figures, not mine, so you don't have to believe me. Of course, if you don't believe the World Bank, then you're in trouble, but anyway. then, during the period that we're talking about, the economy really didn't really recover. It recovered a bit at the beginning, but then tended to decline under these pressures. But then, towards the end of the period, by 88-90, with this cumulative effect of the war, income had really fallen again, so that by the time the government changes in 1990, there went on declining, and it's really gone down, you see, from its peak to about a third of its level before the peak. And this is the recovery. Even today, income per capita in Nicaragua has not recovered its pre-war level, right? I mean, so they remain as one of the poorest countries in Latin America after Haiti. So the effect of this original insurrection and then the continued pressure from outside was really overdetermined any effect that we could have in terms of economic planning and so on and so forth. Is this all coherent? Can you hear? Or I can provide more photographs of singing and dancing people.
Please do.
One more, will you? There's some more. You will amuse you immensely in a minute. So the key thing is that the Somoza group basically dominated the latifundia in the economy, so those were taken over. But food was controlled by the peasantry, so you had a sort of dual structure where the large-scale production was controlled by the state and was being invested in very modern, and then the peasantry were really controlling the food supply, which obviously means in a sense that it's as if you were talking about heavy industry, which is the large export sectors, and the peasants were controlling food and thus consumption as a whole. So a key issue throughout was how to handle relationships with the peasantry so as to secure their support, their long-term development, because they're the poorest people, health and education, but also supply of food for the cities. And this was a central issue throughout this period, one which previous revolutions had not really faced up to, particularly the Cubans. Now, the first stage of the land reform was actually to try and push the peasants into cooperatives, right, and to extend the state sector. But there was a lot of resistance from small producers. A lot of us argued at the time that really it was more important to supply marketing services and credit services to small producers and not try and force them into large co-ops. The internal support for the Contras during from about 1983 onwards, particularly in the northern part of the country, was the result of a failure to distribute land, but instead to try and force people into collectives. There was just a feeling among the government that they wanted sort of large-scale modern production, and that was the way to go, and that we shouldn't be really encouraging people to produce on a small scale, and so on and so forth. You know, sort of classical problem in revolutions. And there was enormous internal debate about that, which was a very interesting debate. In stage two, that was from 85 onwards, the land reform model was in consequence changed, right? Particularly because of this, you know, the peasantry were revealing their views, A, by not supplying food to the towns, and B, by supporting the Contras, right? So you've got a shift of it. And the idea of there would be land distribution, less production co-ops instead of the low production cooperatives, and there would be what was called the articulation of the modes of production to try and actually provide marketing services and credit and training to actual small producers. And so what you got was the slow emergence of a new agrarian middle class, if you like, which was what, of course, the classical socialist model tries to avoid. I mean, it's the idea that you, by having state control of agriculture, you stop. But in fact, the policy was switched to actually encourage that development. And in fact, now in the 2000s, one of the bases, if you like, of political support of the Sandinistas is actually this new sort of middle farmer and small farmer class, who are the beneficiaries of the second stage of the land reform. I remember again, those who are old enough, or those of you like Hal, study these things, the Alliance for Progress, that is the Kennedy program of land reform in Latin America, was based precisely on the idea that redistributing land would create a rural middle class. And in fact, this is what in the end happened, by necessity rather than design. The second thing is that the idea of basic needs, or as it was called then, or is often now called human development, the idea of a development strategy that would be based on actually redistribution towards the poor and the supply of health and education, we see as nowadays as just, you know, that's what development's about. But remember in the 1970s, that wasn't the case. And so the first revolution that was influenced by these ideas, which were then quite new, was the Sandinista one, and it's the first one to actually attempt to supply health and education, on primary health, primary education, outside hospitals, right? Often outside schools, on the basis of mass mobilization. Right? And primary health and primary education were the priorities rather than secondary health and secondary education. Primary health would be based on attention to women and children, which again, now you would just take for granted, but then was a radical idea and regarded as quite new. And primary education, again, based not on schools, but on mass literacy campaigns. And these were the main priorities. So again, this was a new set of ideas that had been emerging in Latin America, alongside ideas about new social movements and all sorts of things, but nobody had put into practice at all. So this is the first time they've been put into practice on a mass scale. There was a very rapid process. What was interesting is that the mobilization, both for the huge literacy campaigns and also for the primary health campaigns, was actually secondary school children and university students. Right? To get the manpower on a scale, the universities were actually closed, right? And that the entire university population moved out to the countryside to do the literacy campaign. Right? And that was in 1980. And in 1981, the same was done with the anti-malaria campaign and the, you know, for spraying for mosquitoes and all these sort of things, and the TB inoculation campaigns and so on. It's entirely based on senior secondary school kids and the entire university. And this, again, had very obvious political implications because it was the first time that an awful lot of these kids, particularly from Managua, had actually been out in the countryside and actually lived there and seen how poor people were and so on and so forth. And just a small example, the secondary school kids, including my own sons and university students, were mobilized during the coffee campaigns in the northern areas where the fighting was going on to pick coffee. Now, originally they were sent as volunteers, and they weren't paid anything. They were just given some food and weren't paid anything. But the local peasantry, and particularly the sort of trade union organisers and peasant organisers, said, no, they must be paid, you know, full wage. Now, the wage in coffee picking is actually not so much per day, but so much per kilo. You know? And of course, what the students immediately found out was they were hardly earning enough in a day to buy Coca-Cola and chips in the evening, right? Because it's the first time they realized how little ordinary people were, and also how low their productivity was compared to the peasant pickers who were able to pick, you know, five times more coffee in a day than they could. But even so, were only earning enough for five Cokes. So there was these efforts were not just a labor supply problem, but actually attempts to educate, if you like, particularly the urban middle class. The interesting thing is that there was huge involvement of the international NGOs in these activities. Right? Again, remember that, you know, we see these NGOs as sort of normal part of, you know, Latin American scene, right? Both national and international NGOs. They weren't then, right? They're all new in the 70s. They didn't exist before, right? So that their first experiences of actually moving from micro, little projects, you know, in some village somewhere, to actually working with the government, which was implementing across the board, was in Nicaragua, right? And in fact, you know, we can see the Oxford-Lyon Association and Trust up there. I mean, all over Europe and all over the United States, there are people who did work in Nicaragua in this period, in the early 80s, and you know, went back and had this experience. So it's important to, and of course the European aid effort and support for Nicaragua was based to a considerable extent on the impact of their own NGOs going and working in Nicaragua, and of course applying political pressure back here, right? So that, I mean, the policy of the British government or the French government or the Spanish government was heavily influenced by the NGOs that were working over there. And on top of that, the Catholic Church, which, of course, was divided as ever on these issues, but at the time, the sort of whole ideas of liberation theology and so on were terribly important. Again, to a country where there were liberation theologians all over the place, including 4 cabinet ministers, right? 4 cabinet ministers were Catholic priests, right? All of them associated with the theology of liberation movement. So again, the impact on sort of progressive Catholics in the States and Europe was enormous, and also that then worked out to progressive Protestant groups, Quakers and so on and so forth, all of whom. Again, this was completely new. No other revolution before or since has actually been supported by these sort of base groups in the States or anywhere else. I mean, certainly the Cuban Revolution wasn't. And the only equivalent you get is on with diaspora communities, let's say support for Israel or something, which is, of course, a different dynamic. But, I mean, the idea that sort of, you know, that, I don't know, church groups in Wichita or something might be, you know, actually interested in Nicaragua was, you know, it wouldn't be interested in anywhere else in the world. And then it had a knock-on effect, obviously, on NGO activities after that. Well, just one of the results of these campaigns, both in literacy and women and child health, were enormously successful. I mean, just to give you one example, at the beginning of the period, 78, the deaths, child mortality, infant mortality is the main, one of the main simple indicators of welfare for the poor, it's in the Millennium Development Goals and so on. Well, that was about 120 per thousand, not per hundred,1978. In other words, that out of every 1,000 births, 12 are dead before they reach the age of 5. By the end of this period, by 1990, that had been cut right all the way down to 65, 66, right? So it was a halving, right? A more than a halving of the infant mortality rate. The Latin American mean in 1990 was 54, so that's pretty near to getting to the Latin American mean in a period of 10 years. So it was an enormous effort to do that. But that was mainly by concentrating on women and child's health, and not in hospitals, but in the field. Using all these university students. So I said the INGOs were an important part of this political project. They were new then on the international cooperation scene, as I've said, and this was the first case that they found a government rather than just projects which they felt they could support and which they could involve en masse. It also, as I said, affected domestic politics in North America and the European Union. As I said, it's the only time since, apart from diaspora politics. And also, of course, the NGOs had, as in the rest of Latin America, an enormous effect on fostering civil society in Nicaragua. That is, and throughout Latin America, if you really ask yourself what's been the driving force in developing civil society, it has been NGOs with the support of their external partners. And, of course, that changed the nature of NGOs themselves, so that the NGOs in the UK, Oxfam and so on, were fundamentally affected by this process. There's a lot of history to be written here, which hasn't been written, I think. There was enormous interest. I mean, the Google Ingram, this is a program which checks all, through Google, all the books available electronically around the world. And this is just a graph of the number of times the word Sandinista is mentioned. No?
In the title or in the text?
In the text. I mean, you can do it for anything. I mean. Mm-hmm. You can see, I mean, it's amazing. It just takes off right to the beginning, just where the, you know, when the fighting is starting, and then you know, reaches a peak about 1990, and then immediately begins to decline again there. But I mean, it's an absolutely enormous surge. I mean, you can do graphs for other words, and you'd see how relative that is. But it's just an indicator of interest of this surge and then decline again. So what this left-hand column means, it's the percentage of all the words in all the Google Scholar books, right? So, you know, 0.0025% of all the words, right, including the and thing, is Sandinista, or anything else you care to put in. So much for the social dimensions and economic. The war itself, well, as I said, production had fallen by 40% during the insurrection itself. Not so much by direct destruction, but more by sort of disarticulation of the system. The credit system breaks down, the transport system breaks down, people can't sell things, marketing doesn't work, and so on, so production does tend to collapse. Now, from 1981, when Reagan was installed, part of the Republican line, of course, was that Carter had been too soft and wimpy and so on and so forth, and that Reagan, you know, the sort of cowboy. Well, that's interesting to know that, you know, that Reagan, people always say that Reagan was a film star. He was actually a trade union organizer. That's what he actually lived on. His films were awful and very few. I mean, he was actually a trade union organizer in Hollywood, is what he did. Anyway, the administration imposed a trade embargo by refusing to allow the US or US companies to trade. Again, totally illegal. A financial veto blocking all aid from any institution they had any influence in, particularly the World Bank and the IDB, the IMF, and so on. And came to the point of actually mining the harbours, I mean, putting mines in the harbours. So it's pretty extreme behaviour. This was funded, they funded and trained and directed from Honduras. Ambassador Negroponte was running the Contras out of Honduras. And then there was the constant threat of invasion. Remember that Grenada was invaded in 1981 and that Panama was invaded.
83, sorry.
And Panama in 1989. So it wasn't a sort of empty threat. I mean, there's this constant fear of invasion. You're right, sorry. Now, the question is why the US took this endless discussions, because, of course, how to deal with it. It was clear from the very beginning that it was not a strategic threat, and the USSR was anyway falling apart, as I'll mention in a moment, but it also made it very clear that they weren't committing troops or missiles or anything to the group. So I think the main issue was that it was a bad example, like Chile, that, you know, if a domino effect, that if it started in one country, then it would spread to other ones. I mean, Chile didn't represent, in any sense, a strategic threat to the US, but it represented a threat, if you like, to influence in the region. There was no prospect of strategic support from the USSR, and like Cuba, from the very first days, they made it absolutely clear that they would not. But a big difference was major oil supplies from Mexico and Venezuela, which supplied oil at A, low prices, and B, on, you know, credit terms, which basically everybody knew wouldn't be paid back. Interestingly, a small part of that aid effort, from Mexico at least, was me, because I was actually under contract to the Mexican Secretaría de Programación y Presupuesto. After the student had rung me, I went to see the minister and said, please, can I go? And can you release me with a contract? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, because you're going on behalf of the Mexican people to Nicaragua. Sent us off as part of the Mexican aid effort. So And of course, there was continued aid from the European Union and so on until quite late, quite late on. Well, I said I'd show you some more photographs. Now, these are. This is the same person up there, with the beard on, because I was drafted. The entire everybody in the presidency was drafted into the armed forces, and put me in a slightly difficult position. But then I, to my immense pleasure, was told that I could opt for the fire brigade, so I became deputy head of the fire brigade, presidential fire brigade. So this is my card from the Servicio Militar de Reserva, the reserve military card, my number. When I was filling in the application forms, you had to fill in your class affiliation, right? So I wrote Pequeño Burgués on my form, and the recruiting officer just calmly crossed out the Pequeño. By his standards, I wasn't, so I got upgraded, if you like, an upgrade to business class on my form. But unfortunately, it doesn't say that on the form, on the card. I wish it had, but it didn't. This is the military hospital inscription card, and this is my arms license for carrying arms for self-defense. This is me again, looking suitable for the part, I think, with the beard. And as I said, I became deputy head of the fire brigade. Problem was, the only fire we ever had, which was a fire in the stationery cupboard, happened when I was in Costa Rica. So I missed the only chance, but I was trained. I mean, I can actually unroll, even, you know, gone into flaming houses with
the hose.
Hoses and
what about stuff. Your firearms? Did you get trained in
trained on the firearms for self-defense purposes. So anyway, that's enough of that. So one of the reasons why things went wrong, and I think we lost the elections, and also the economy began to fall apart, were issues to do with military response to the US pressure. Now, immediately after the revolution, there hadn't been an army in the sense there was the Guardia Nacional, which was a sort of police force, National Guard, which had been very much a sort of Somoza project being set up. So there wasn't any army in the normal sense of the word. So they wanted to establish an army and a separate police force. And of course, it had been a volunteer army during the revolution. They wanted it to be based on, you know, military service, conscription. And really there was peasant resistance to both to the formalization of the military rather than having self-defense, and to them being conscripted, their sons being conscripted and fighting in areas other than where they lived. So that there was the formalization, if you like, of the army was an immediate problem, particularly in the countryside, but increasingly in the towns. Now, from 85 onwards, they actually shifted the strategy towards counterinsurgency strategy based on sending, in effect, guerrilla columns led by people who had been guerrilleros before, and guerrilleros sending military columns into the countryside to find the contras directly rather than trying to fight pitched battles and so on, and to fight them in those terms. And that was enormously successful. Right? The problem is that the army insisted on also having a formal defense strategy in terms of anti-aircrafts and air bases and tanks and so on to face this expected US invasion. And the combination of having two military strategies at the same time really broke the bank. It was incidentally the reason why I eventually stopped being economic advisor, because I felt that this was a mistake financially, and also, but at the end of the day, I suppose I was arguing that the huge expenditure on hardware and so on was, cement and so on to build redoubts and so on was wrecking the economy, but they pointed out to me that in the end of the day, I wasn't a military advisor, I was an economic advisor, and you know, this wasn't my job. But in the end, it was really about that as much as about economics as such. Then in stage three, 1987, you've got the Esquipulas peace accords with the Central American neighbors. But the US pressure really continued. None of the embargo or the finance for the Contra. You remember the Contra then had to be financed through the Iran-Contra, through the scan, you know, these various back channels and so on. But the defense strategy really overburdened the economy and the society, plus the distraction by the Contras and the inflation and shortages, plus the effect of the draft, the military draft of young people, led to the election defeat in 1990. People were exhausted and really couldn't go on, and that they felt that this sort of it was just hopeless to go on opposing the US if they were going to do this. So in the early 80s, we'd also been suing the United States at the International Court of Justice because we couldn't get any redress in the UN Security Council because, of course, the US veto of the Security Council stopped it. So we shifted the case to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. And one of my jobs was to working out the evidence of the economic damage from US intervention on mining harbors, on the effect of the trade embargo, on increasing the costs of trade, of calculating the amount of destruction done by the Contra, and the additional defense costs and so on. And this was presented at The Hague. Now, to our amazement, in 1986, the court actually ruled in favor of McGregor against the US. This is the first and only time that any country has been brought to book for what in effect is state terrorism. But in fact, it was the US. The court called on the US to cease and refrain from unlawful use of force against McGregor and ordered reparations. Now, in fact, in the late 80s, then I was working on macroeconomic modelling of the GDP loss on the argument that the reparations aren't just the destruction, but actually what the lawyers call lucrum cessans, that is, what if a machine is destroyed, what you should be compensated for is not only the cost of the machine, but also the profits, if you like, you might have made out of that machine. Now, the interesting thing about this concept is it's established in international law, but it's usually used by companies claiming money when they've been expropriated, you know? Mm-hmm. Starting with the Barcelona traction case and so on and so forth. So it's well established, but it's usually against nationalizing states, which tend to be in developing countries. So it tends to be used by multinationals arguing against developing country governments. Now, this is an argument that we use successfully of Nicaragua against the US. Surprise, surprise, the US refused to pay the reparations despite its treaty obligations. Remember, the US is a signatory to the International Court of Justice, and it can't just say that you can't just say I'm not going to fulfill my treaty obligations. But they managed to delay everything, and of course in 1990 the FSLN lost the elections. The succeeding Chamorro government dropped the case in exchange for renewed US aid. So that was the end of that. But I mean, I think again, as in the cases I've been explaining before, like the NGOs and so on, these are permanent impacts on international law. Right, I think are a legacy, an interesting sort of legacy. Certainly, it was fascinating working on this legally. One of the odd problems I had in working in the court in The Hague was I used to go on my bicycle, and the problem is there was a bicycle rack. This is very Dutch. There was a bicycle rack, of course, for employees. The employees were all supposed to go, right? But there was no bicycle rack for legal teams. Because legal teams would appear in large Mercedes, by definition. So it's a great problem for them that I wasn't allowed to put my bike in the bike rack. I tried then to chain it to the huge balustrade, where the Mercedes are parked. But they said I couldn't do that either. So when they come back, I said, it's absolutely hopeless. You'll have to go down in the street outside and walk up here because we can't work out how to handle somebody in a legal team who actually comes on a bike. So that's Dutch, the Dutch for you. Well, what are we to say about this? Well, in a bit of a way, I would suggest that it has some of the elements of a Greek tragedy, in the sense that the outcome, or a death foretold, if you like, that the outcome was always, in a sense, it was never going to work. The Sandinistas in particular were clear that in the end it wouldn't really work. In fact, I asked some of the Capitan Guevara, who was a, I don't know if anything you know about Nicaraguan poetry and so on, but Ernesto Cardenal had a sort of community on the lake called Solentiname, which was very famous and also produced the Misa Campesina and all those. So he had been a fisherman there. He was a guerrilla commander. And I asked him, Capitan, I said, what do you think of all this economic planning and economic difficulties and all the sort of stuff we're working on? And he said, I never expected to see Somoza gone, right? Todo el resto es extra time, extra play. It was just like a football match. It was just extra time after that. They never really expected anything else. They didn't expect to be alive to see Somoza gone. Now, the thing is that to try and change society and economy in one small country and oppose the US all at the same time was really probably doomed to failure, and everybody knew that. So there was a sense of a Greek tragedy that it's all going to end in tears. The USSR was collapsing anyway. It was quite unwilling to defend Nicaragua as it had Cuba. Now, the mistake was not this. The Frente Sandinista's mistake was not thinking that it was all going to work. It was they expected the end game to be different. They expected either the revolution to spread in Central America. Remember, El Salvador was in arms, right? Guatemala was in arms. Honduras was in collapse. The prospect of the spread looked good, which was precisely why Reagan was intervening. Or they expected a full-scale U.S. invasion, a la Grenada or Panama. Which again, would lead to revulsion in the rest of the world and so on and so forth. But neither of those happened. What in fact happened was a sort of war of attrition, and in a sense, the 1998 election, the electorate were recognizing the inevitability that this just wasn't going to work. What is left after all this? Well, for the next 16 years, there were very ineffective liberalizing governments. There was no resolution of power because the Frente Sandinista held on to half the votes. It had very strong influence in the army and the police. The FLN itself split into the sort of core around Daniel Ortega, and practically everybody else of importance moved out into the MERS and then into sorts of retirement. In effect, you had a veto. The Sandinistas could veto anything, but they couldn't get anything done. Right? So you have a sort of permanent standoff. Economic stagnation, social decomposition, the gang warfare and so on and so forth, drug trade, huge amounts of emigration, vast numbers of people moved out to Costa Rica, the United States, and everywhere else. Really wasn't going anywhere. Since 2007, that's for the last 7 years, the rump, if you like, of the FSLN has retained power. Remember, they hold on to 40% of the vote, and they have very strong bases. This isn't a small dictatorship. Populist government, a new type of mixed economy. The ALBA, that is, Venezuela and Bolivia and so on, continue to aid. There's political stasis. The only hope at the moment is the Gran Canal, the new canal, which is sort of the new novel-like hope. So really nothing has been resolved since then. So we're 100 years on from the original invasion, but really, in a sense, the problem of the state has not really been resolved in Nicaragua after all this time. That's the proposed route of the new canal through here, which of course was the original canal route. Remember, Panama was the second best, but it was more convenient for a whole series of reasons. But this, we could discuss that later. Does it still matter, this the Revolución Popular Sandinista? You could say it matters to me, but this is just an old man's recovering his lost youth. I mean, it's equivalent of a Madeleine for tea. A sort of tropical Madeleine. I think that, you know, everybody agrees or says they agree on poverty reduction, human development, inequality reduction as aims and so on. But what does it really mean if you take it seriously in terms of what you have to do in terms of health and education programs and actually shifting the balance of assets, right? Particularly land reform and so on. So the question still remains, if we really take these development aims seriously, are we really prepared to do the necessary? And you see again an example such as Brazil riven apart by even quite modest attempts to redistribute income, just to give one example. Is any sort of alternative model, I mean, it doesn't have to be what we call peripheral socialism, it could be independence or a mixed economy or an ecological economy or a, you know, whatever. Is it really possible if the US, you know, is not going to tolerate it? And then, you know, it was very clear the judgment that international law says that you cannot intervene in another state unless you can demonstrate that your own security, not in general, but in particular, is actually being threatened, right? You know, clearly these principles of international law are being intervened all the time, particularly in the Middle East, but it still remains a basic principle, which has been traditionally a principle in Latin America, at least. I mean, one of the amazing things, actually, is since independence, there have been practically no wars between states in Latin America. I mean, you know, you have to scrape around to find them, and they're pretty pathetic. I mean, you know, it is absolutely amazing, actually, the lack of conflict, and it's part of that tradition, but can it be enforced? But basically, I think what the Nicaraguan case reveals is that, you know, 200 years after independence, you haven't really managed to construct nations in the full sense, right, of a fully modern nation, practically anywhere in the continent. Latin America, obviously, Nicaragua is a disaster example. But if you look around and you say, you know, you say Uruguay, you say Chile, perhaps, with a bit of hope. But, you know, where can you really say that there is, you know, a modern nation state constructed with a civil society, with, you know, what you expect, a social contract and so on. So I think it's a problem throughout the continent, really, that the task that was set up after independence, the construction of the liberal state in the late 19th century, is still 150 years hasn't been done. Still, you know, it's not a proper state or a proper social order in Mexico or, you know, I can't think, Colombia, in Venezuela, not in Argentina, not in, you know, I mean, you'll probably claim it is in Brazil, but it's, you know, pretty new, it's pretty feeble. I mean, you know, it is a real question. I mean, what, you know, are independent nation states with some sort of social order and some sort of political order and some sort of social contract possible at all? Well, that's the end. That's my youngest son, Camilo, being christened. The grizzled Mexican, actually, guerrilla commander, who's his godfather. Radical Jesuit priest, blessing him. That's Angelinas there. So it sums it all up, really, doesn't it?
Okay, thank you. Welcome.